Hello, I'm Emily Ville, founder of Vestpod and author of You're Not Broke, You're Pre-Rich, and you're listening to The Wallet. Every week, we give you the best tips, guidance, and a good dose of inspiration and motivation to manage your money better. Have you ever wondered about the importance of romance in our lives, and that we can find it in and through business? But also how to strike the perfect balance between career ambitions and personal happiness? In today's episode, we are joined by Tim Leberer, an author, creator, and entrepreneur, known as the co-founder of the House of Beautiful Business. Tim, described as a humanist in Silicon Valley, brings a unique perspective as we explore the profound impact of artificial intelligence on our lives and work. He shares insight on designing businesses that prioritize life dimensions beyond market dominance, emphasizing a human-centric approach. Envisioning a future where work becomes a truly beautiful and meaningful experience. Remember that we are not certified financial advisors. Information shared in this podcast is for educational purposes only and does not constitute financial advice. PensionBee is on a mission to help pension savers across the UK. Each month, their Pension Confident podcast helps listeners understand the world of personal finance, exploring pensions, ISAs, mortgages, and more. Host Philippa Lamb is joined by a panel of expert guests who answer questions from can you afford to have kids? To should you invest in a pension or an ISA? The Pension Confident podcast is available right now wherever you get your podcasts. Just remember that anything discussed should not be regarded as financial advice. I've read your book, The Business Romantic, a few years ago. I think it really shaped my vision of business and how I've been building Vestpod over the years. And in the book, you argue that we underestimate the importance of romance in our lives and that we can find it in and through business. And that means by, you know, designing products, services, experiences that connect us with something greater than ourselves. Can we just start by, you know, what is a business romantic?
Can I ask you a question, Emily? Are you a romantic? Would you consider yourself to be a romantic?
I consider myself to be a romantic, yes.
And then do you also consider yourself to be a business romantic? Are you romantic when it comes to work and the way you run your business and you lead?
Yeah, I think, you know, building this business with, you know, very, very strong values and being very mindful of people who worked for the organizations and we people are outside of the organization. So yeah, we've made this business romantic, I feel.
It's the question that I always ask at the beginning of my talks. And usually a lot of hands go up and people believe they are, or they consider themselves to be romantic. Because who does not want to be a romantic? People consider it a key ingredient of living a beautiful life, worth living. But when it comes to business, and I ask people who is a business romantic, who is romantic about their work, fewer hands go up. And that is because business and romance at first glance appear to be fundamentally at odds. They're almost like an obscene couple, if you will, because in business, we've been conditioned to reward realism and pragmatism, and being romantic is associated with something dreamy and lofty and fuzzy, warm and fuzzy, and it's easily made fun of, right? Almost like mocked. You're kind of a laughing stock as a business romantic. And I think that's a big mistake. I believe that in the future, we need more romance because the type of management and the type of business culture that we believed in, that is so based on rationalism and a scientific brand of rationality and numbers and data and winning at all costs, has clearly come to an end, or at least it has proven to be insufficient in addressing some of the challenges that we're facing. So we need to bring in a dimension of ourselves that draws from more than just cognitive, logical intelligence, that draws from our bodies, somatic intelligence, that draws from emotional intelligence, that understands that the arts and the humanities and many of the questions that business is facing right now will not be solved by the traditional canon of business literature and management thinking. The answers are probably coming rather from disciplines outside of traditional business. And the business romantic is someone who understands that. It's someone who believes their intuition, in addition to also, of course, working with data, but not confusing data with the sole objective truth. Really appreciating that there's always another truth out there that is maybe more spiritual, more emotional, that goes deeper. And that is, I believe, the main characteristic of a business romantic. If you look at the history of business, I'd be hard pressed to pinpoint or to find like the quintessential business romantic. I don't know if, you know, it's more of a persona or more of an aspiration than it is an actual personality type or category. Many people would say Steve Jobs maybe was a romantic, at least in the way he thought of a world that wasn't there, that he helped shape, a visionary, a dreamer of sorts. Many entrepreneurs are, but in their demeanor, maybe they're not so much romantic. They're actually very pragmatic. They're very hard. I recently met the CEO and founder of Möbius, this executive leadership, Amy Elizabeth Fox. And her firm and her is actually, I think they're actually a great example of maybe what it could mean to be a romantic or to be a business romantic. They work with leaders from Fortune 500 companies and government leaders worldwide on leadership development programs, on transformational leadership programs that are going much deeper than just being skill-based or just being focused on how to become a more effective motivator or performance enhancer. So they really look at a deeper level, the dreams, the trauma, the fears, the hidden desires of the whole spiritual underpinning of a person. That's the dimension, that's the depth that a business romantic appreciates and wants to bring into the conversation.
For me, transitioning from working in finance, working, you know, in private equity in a big American bank and setting up a business, you're going from one extreme to another, you know, and it's really rethinking completely how you see business, how you see yourself within the organization and the world. But can I ask you, when did business lose its beauty?
I believe probably through Taylorism, the idea of modern management and industrial production and the idea of management as a rationality-based way of controlling creativity and output. I believe that was probably when it lost its beauty, because we forced it into this repeatable pattern of production, in a sense. And then I think the same thing, I mean, that was maybe the first moment of disenchantment. And the second one was the digital transformation, the rise of the surveillance economy and then data economy, the sort of digital Taylorism that we faced then in the 90s and in the early 2000s, when we began to believe in the quantified workplace and the quantified self and the quantification of everything, really assuming that only what we can measure, what we can, has value. So I think that was another moment of disenchantment, another obsession with data, another obsession with one singular truth, in this case, data, that pushed any other form of being and life into to the fringes. And that's really what I feel like the idea of beautiful business or bringing beauty back into the conversation is doing. It's kind of like an inner revolt. It's bringing a language and practices and rituals and a sentimentality and a certain way of feeling back into a world that's largely devoid of that, where we have come to believe that, oh, we can control everything. There is an engineering-based, data-based solution to every single problem on Earth, even the most complex policy question or relationship issues, like problems of really high degrees of ambiguity and mystique. I believe Silicon Valley engineers believe they can solve through data and through engineering solutions. And my book and the Business Romantic Platform and the House of Beautiful Business, the company that I co-founded, we understand ourselves as the antidote to that, you know, to basically state there is another world possible, not just outside of business, but actually inside business. And we can use it as a Trojan horse to revolutionize business from within by bringing some of that thinking into the boardrooms, into the offices of big companies, and creating a spark of a new way of doing business that is hopefully inspiring and that brings in a much bigger version of ourselves as humans than you know, the one that modern management has taught us.
So you talked about Steve Jobs earlier, and it's quite interesting because you see him as a, you know, business romantic. And then my question is around, what's the business case for, you know, making business beautiful? How can we strike a balance between benefiting shareholders, attracting investments? You and me, we need to make money for our businesses, and at the same time adopt a more holistic view of success that goes beyond, you know, these traditional financial metrics and data.
Yeah, there's a lot of research that shows that psychological safety and intrinsic motivation are much more integral to productivity and creativity. So the most successful organizations, at least the lasting successful organizations over a certain period of time, have cultures of psychological safety, have cultures where there is a direct alignment between their mission and the way it is embodied through the bodies of their workers, their spirits, right? So there's a strong spiritual connection between what workers want as the individual purpose and the purpose of an organization. And that, to me, is beautiful. That harmony, that attunement is beautiful. That sensitivity is beautiful. And psychological safety is created by creating a culture where we not only honor positive emotions, which is so often the toxic positivity that we think of when we think of sort of the Silicon Valley campuses and modern workplace where there are ping pong tables and chefs and the goal is to make everybody happy all the time. But I always say that the more human or beautiful workplace is one where we can also be sad, where we have complicated emotions, where we can show up as much more complicated, conflicted selves. And that is really beautiful. And beautiful is also what is not objectively measurable. You know, there is no objective measurement for beauty. So it's this extra parallel space that we can't quite put our finger on. And especially with the rise of AI, it is so important to understand that the work that must be done beautifully, so with discretion, with imagination, with empathy, with love, that is the work that will remain inherently human. Anything else that can be automated, that can be made more efficiently, not necessarily only more beautifully, that will be very easily relegated to machines and to AI. So beauty is also the ultimate bastion. It's the bulwark. It's the only remaining space for us to do our work. And that's also where we find meaning. If we have discretion to do our work beautifully, to give it an extra shot of imagination, to do it with care, to do it with love, and not just to do it for the bottom line or to get the job done, that's also when we're happier. You know, we are more fulfilled, we do more meaningful work, and the results for the organization will be better, and the result for the individual will be better. But the last thing I would say is, I mean, these are all arguments that are still within the context of existing return on investment thinking, right? So those are business benefits of creating beauty to organizations. But for me, the bigger thing is that I see businesses and business, the economy in general, also not just as a way to grow or to create, you know, value that's distributed among members of a society, but it is also, it's an undertaking that creates meaning. Companies are meaning makers. They are arbiters of meaning. They give us identity. They give us a way to integrate into society. And beauty is so crucial in that context. So we spend so much time at work, 65, 70% of our waking hours as modern knowledge workers. Why would we want these places to be robotic, automated, cold, bureaucratic machines? You know, we want them to be gardens, flowers, beautiful, with all the mystery and the subtle undertones that we have in our lives. Why would we want to get rid of that in business? So that's the other argument I would make here. It's not just a business benefit. It's also there is a responsibility of business to create beauty, to make our world a better place.
You talk about the importance of you have to love what you do. How can we strike a business? How can we strike a balance, between our own career ambitions and maybe going to work for these companies that are not very romantic, but where maybe you can have a very good start of your career and maybe make a lot of money and save and then make other choices, this and personal happiness? I think that's a conversation we're having a lot at the moment.
Yeah. And I mean, I know more and more people in my network who are no longer in their corporate jobs. I barely know people who actually are in their corporate jobs. But I think it's everybody's decision and it depends on the context. Some people are very happy to have, as long as they're agency, that's what all research shows, right? If there's a notion of self-efficacy and of agency, then people are usually more fulfilled and of psychological safety, which I mentioned before. That can take place in the context of an enterprise, of a business, of an organization. It can also be as a freelancer or as a solo entrepreneur or as an artist. What is really important is to think as your work, of your work, if you have the privilege to do so, as your life's work. And it's interesting to look at the definition of work. It's energy distributed over time and distance, if you will, the strict scientific definition. And when we look back on our lives, boy, do we spend a lot of energy, right? It's like we're exhausting ourselves. And of course, we're also regenerating, but there's a lot of energy that is driving us, that is very much at the heart of what we do. How do we spend it? You know, in which relationships, to what effect, in which collaborations do we spend this energy? What is the work that is our life's work? That is the work that we really want to contribute to this planet, to this life of ours. And if we can define that, if we understand what our purpose is, then I believe maybe it doesn't matter as much what the context is. You can do that work in an organization. You can do it yourself. My friend Priya Parker, the author of the book, The Art of Gathering, she always has this, she asks this question when she does purpose coaching. And I really love this question. She says, what is the one positive change that only you have the capacity and passion to affect? What is the one positive change in the world that only you have the capacity and passion to affect? That's the purpose question. If you can answer that question, then that's your guiding principle. That's your through line. That's your filter by which you can make all of your career decisions. So for me, this was really helpful. And I would encourage everybody else also to think about this question. And then you can make decisions that align with your purpose, and a better balance is likely the result of it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Priya Parker is definitely very inspiring. And I make sure I reread her book each time I'm planning for our yearly festival, to make sure, you know, things work out and we, you know, again, commit to our mission and to what we're doing. Can I ask you about the House of Beautiful Business? Because you started the business after you wrote the book. So how did you design this business that prioritized, you know, all facets of life above maybe market domination and, you know, capitalism? And we can talk about these different concepts. But what was your own experience of building your business?
I was really inspired to build my own business after I witnessed other cultures in the creative economy, where I worked for a design firm. And I love working for that design firm. But I also realized that there was still so much traditional energy there. You know, it was in a way still very masculine. It was very much about assertion and domination and competition and extraction. So the consciousness was there, but the practices and the demeanor didn't live up to it. There was a big disconnect still. And then I worked actually very closely as a chief marketing officer at the time with a private equity firm. And I was shocked by it. On the one hand, I was impressed by their smarts and their number crunching, but I was shocked by their ruthlessness and how much value they were willing to destroy for the bottom line, how much cultural value and social value and emotional damage they were ready to do to inflict on an organization. And so that's why I wrote my book, and that's also why I developed this appetite for developing my own organization. And with the House of Beautiful Business, we created some principles that are rather quirky, where we say, you know, mystique over clarity, or intimacy beats connection. And so that really helped us steer the ship. And we also designed it as a community more than anything else. So it's less an organization with formal boundaries and much more of a, to use this very fashionable term, ecosystem of thinkers and members. And they're not loyal to us because we have a contract with them or there's a formal relationship. They're loyal to us because there's love and there's affection and there's trust, mutual trust. And that was also really important for us. And the last thing I would say is that, we always try to earn the license to play and to be very imaginative. I mean, that's also why organizations come to us, Fortune 500 companies. They want us to be different. They want us to rock the boat a bit. They want us to be an instigator. So we're in this really nice position, you know, to be able to do that. In terms of like growing our own business, you know, we also are, and maybe that's both a curse and a blessing. We are kind of stuck in between. So, you know, our own organization structures, we have traditional strategic investors, we have angel investors, we also need to grow. People look at our results, we're a business. So that's one side of the equation. On the other side, we also want to be different, and we question the very principles and the very foundations of the system that we are part of. So that's tricky, and that often creates a bit of tension, to be honest. At the same time, I feel also it makes us, it sort of keeps us honest. And we are in a position where we can speak both languages, and we understand ourselves as a mediator, as a bridge between very corporate pragmatic speak, so we can talk to organizations and speak their language and bring them into the house. So we're not too out there, too esoteric. On the other hand, we try to identify ideas and think bold ideas and question everything very radically. So we can do both, and but not alienating from you know, not disconnecting from either of the two camps.
Yeah, I love the fact that you're quite agile and you can, you know, speak to different audiences. I think that's, you know, a challenge, and it's not being, you know, black and white, but really working with these organizations. Can you talk a little bit about how businesses can empower more their employees, you know, individuals who work for them, encouraging them to be themselves at work? I think, you know, we talk a lot about the culture not being, you know, ping pong table and free lunch, but how can we promote, maybe, you know, it's wellness. We often, I mean, at Vesper, we often talk about promoting financial wellness within the workforce. So what can businesses do to help their employees?
Creating educational measures and just really incorporating into the very fabric of a day-to-day business, using business as a, understanding any organization as a learning and an understanding organization. I mean, it's like, especially with other social institutions in demise, churches, you know, community colleges, there are not so many social places left where we meet someone whom we necessarily handpicked. Right, so we have to engage with the other, and it's a big social arena, the workplace, whether it's virtual or in person. So there is this opportunity for businesses to offer educational programs and to help people shape their identity and develop agency. It's what I said earlier, that research proves, right, that people have a sense of agency and self-efficacy and of having making an impact and having control, that they're happier, that they're more fulfilled. So for businesses, this means creating space, creating literacy. So, for example, if I were now with the rise of generative AI, this is very threatening, very scary for many workers, for me included, because I don't understand it. It's very cryptic and the language is very alienating and exclusionary. The same was true for blockchain and Web 3.0. So we partnered, for example, with clients and tried to create learning journeys on Web 3.0 and trying to demystify really the language and the practices. That's something that businesses can do. That would create trust. But it's also the behavior of the leader who embodies empathy and compassion and truly cares. This example of when we talk about mental health of a CEO, I forgot which company it was and which CEO, but there was the CEO who wrote in his out of office reply, "I'm taking a mental health day. You know, I'm not reachable today." And it's these little gestures, gestures that just go a long way, that basically convey to an organization, it is okay not to feel perfectly happy all the time. It is okay to have complicated emotions. It is okay to look after your mental health, and not just because mental health and well-being boosts productivity, but because it's a virtue in and of itself. You know, so I'm always averse to this business case for diversity or this business case for mental health. Yeah, clearly there is one, but that's not the point. The point is that mental health and well-being and diversity are absolutely paramount, period. And businesses are vehicles to accomplish them and to role model them. I think that's how I would approach this. And so, yeah, so and I think the last thing I would say is that that empowers or engages people or fosters employee engagement is just a real alignment between rhetoric and action. I think workers become very cynical if they feel that what an organization is saying doesn't match the reality. Have to match it 100%, but if there's sort of really a lack of genuine attempt to align a reality with the rhetoric and the mission, then people check out immediately. And I think that's very often the case. And there's even research saying that most managers believe that they actually overstate the degree to which workers buy into the mission, when in fact many workers don't really believe it and they think it's just mere rhetoric and lip service. So that's another field where organizations, I think, can really be much more honest, maybe promise less, deliver more, and not risk people becoming cynical because they're looking at the what is coming out of the mouth of an organization, and they're looking at the workplace and they're realizing, oh God, this is far from my reality every day.
I just wanted to talk about this article that you published in December. In a broken world, broken heart, love company, neither the political nor the personal can be fixed. Where you talk about your personal experience of being broken and how, you know, this is part of life, this is part of being alive. And I was wondering, you know, in our current state of ideological division, cancel culture, what's happening in the world, how can we have meaningful conversations? Because sometimes that can be really difficult.
Yeah. I wrote the article because I noticed, having had a lot of conversations with friends about the recent war in Gaza, Ukraine, and also, I think, just growing ideological, political division, right, in the United States and elsewhere, growing polarization, rise of totalitarian regimes, democracy in decline, and so many other things. But I believe with the recent conflict, in particular, the war in Gaza, it just suddenly became, it's so personal right now, and it kind of infiltrated every single relationship. So I think it was a reminder that every single most intimate personal relationship is also inherently political. And which also means that if we want to create a culture of mutual understanding and dialogue, it starts with the two of us, you know, at the smallest unit of social interaction. And I think what is so worrisome is that we've now so prone to feeding that big outrage machine that is social media. Clearly money is made, right, with the outrage and the emotions that we share and with the most intimate fears and angers that we feed this monster with. And that it has led to a lack of nuance or subtlety, that we think in tweets, that we think in taglines, that we think in compelling viral TikTok videos and Insta reel, all of the expense of nuance of having a more in-depth conversation, context is lacking, and so often. And I think what we're seeing is also that there is this expectation to take a stance. That's true for brands and for organizations, but also for us as individuals. And while I believe that is very important to have a distinctive point of view, and of course to take a stance at some point, I just don't think we should do it without proper thinking, and we need time for contemplation, we need time for reflection, and we need time to really understand the other. And this goes back to maybe the notion of this data-driven capitalism that I mentioned earlier, that it has sort of made us believe that there is a science-based, data-based, objective version of the truth. And it has turned us into these binary thinkers, when in fact everything is much more complicated and requires context. So I just hope that the voices that try to understand both or multiple sides, that they still have room, and that sometimes we just have to calm down and that we have to sit with an issue instead of just shouting at each other immediately and, you know, forced to take a stance, because it's just not going to help. And that we actually find something, mutual, you know, something small that we can agree on. And I think this goes back to intimacy. I think if a group of people experiences emotional intimacy with one another, that is really such a strong foundation for then collaboration and partnership and maybe bigger, better understanding on ideological issues. We at the House of Beautiful Business, we do silent dinners. We work with silence a lot. And silence is so powerful because it just takes away the language, the rhetoric, which can often be very aggressive. Like we use, especially in business, we use language to assert, to make a point, to be aggressive about an idea or territory or to defend. But if we remove that and we just sit and in silence, there's a tenderness and we see each other maybe differently. And, I sometimes wish it would be, I mean, how amazing it would be, maybe this is a very naive idea, but how amazing it would be for world leaders, conflicting parties, just to spend 2-3 hours in silence together, meditating, seeing each other, experiencing each other differently. So that's what worries me. And I'm worried by cancel culture and by by statements being reduced to snippets and sound bites and taken out of context and then turned against ourselves as weaponry, as rhetorical weaponry and deplatforming, when in fact we need to give space to as many voices as possible. Not all of them, of course, there are boundaries. I understand that as well. But the current climate, this heated climate of cancellation and rushing to conclusions and lack of context, I think is fundamentally undermining any public discourse, any civilatory society. So I'm really troubled by it.
Thank you, Tim. A pleasure, you know, talking to you today after, you know, following your work. And I think it's really refreshing to see that, you know, business can work for individuals, it can work for society, and that we can create change within our organizations. Do you have anything else to add, maybe about the next, House of Beautiful Business, community meetup or where we can find you?
Yeah, I would just love to invite everybody to join the House of Beautiful Business. It's very easy. You just have to subscribe to our newsletter or attend one of our events. There are no hurdles. There's no entry criteria. Go to houseofbeautifulbusiness.com, check it out. And if you feel like that's your thing, and that's your vibe, that's your tribe, then join us.
We're back next Thursday for more Dragon Free Money Talk. Make sure you hit subscribe or follow, whatever your app says, so you don't miss the next episode.